Content warnings for this episode include discussion about stalkers, medical negligence and not believing women, especially about medical things, the Club Q shooting, intentional misinformation, such as on Twitter, and earthquakes. Hello, friends. Greetings. Hello, all of you. You're listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. My name is Pace Warfield May, and I am... Oh, fuck. I really don't have anything.
I know. I was like,
this is such a strange movie. Okay. Yeah. My name is Pace Cerulean Warfield May because I have this fancy middle name, which I never get to use, so might as well say it. Mm-hmm. Don't steal my identity, folks. So my name is Pace Cerulean Warfield May, and I am the head of the serpent that is eating its tail, which is basically what this film feels like an attempt at showing.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the... Oh, I had one. I just had one that I came up with that I was like, ah, brilliant. I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the script within a script within a script.
Love it. So, any announcements? Well, first, how have you been?
Good. We're in the process of moving, so everything in my life feels like mass chaos all the time. But hopefully by the time this episode comes out, we will be moved. We'll see. that's the hope.
But, fingers crossed for you and your household as you move.
What about you? How are you doing?
I've been better, but I mean, it's a holiday. We're recording this the day before Thanksgiving, so it's kind of like a holiday stuff. So there's all sorts of feelings mixed in there. For us queer folk, but definitely go for many of our listeners who are queer, definitely go listen to our queer holiday survival guide, which I'll link in the show notes, which talks about some of that, quite frankly and realistically. And for you allies to queer people, definitely listen to it as well, because there's tips in there, but also it can help with your empathy and compassion for us queer folk, because you understand why all of us are so pissy and depressed right now.
Yes, it is definitely great prep for the time to come. Yeah. Also, speaking of the holidays, our Adventmas Finny movie, our Adventmas Finny calendar is up and running. So we are watching movies or shows or listening to songs or doing art or all of the above for the different prompts for each day. And you can check it out from the diakonia.faith Facebook page, but also follow and use the hashtag AdventMissFinny. And we'll share here what folks are doing. So I know we haven't started yet, but by the time this episode comes out, we will be several days in. So I would just like to do a shout out for Advent, the first couple of days, and we can maybe entice people into what they might.
For sure. And because Emily and I overplan a lot and really like spreadsheets, we already have picked out the movies for the first few ones, so we can tell you what we plan to be watching and will have watched by the time this comes out. Speaking of meta-ness. So, yeah, this comes out, this episode drops December 1st. So that's 5 days into Advent. But, yes. But yeah, check out the Advent movie calendar. The first day of Advent, the category to try to watch a film is a non-human protagonist. Would you like to share what you'd be watching for that?
Yes, I am doing Balto.
Adorable movie.
Yes.
The animated one, I assume, because that's...
Mm-hmm. Togo is coming up later. But yeah, the episode, the animated Balto. What are you watching?
I decided to go classic Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the 1964 special.
Nice.
Yeah, nice. Start off with something a little retro.
You know what else would be great? Hmm. Elliot, the Smallest Reindeer. I don't think I put that on my list. I'm going to have to, like, make it a special one.
Fair, fair. Then November 28th, which that is one. Also somebody's birthday.
Uh-huh. It's my birthday. And so for my birthday, our film prompt thing is a title that's a pun.
Yeah.
So what are you punning for that? Or what will you have punned?
I'm watching this delightfully gay movie that came out in 2009. So, like, it's very much gay, not as much queer, but it's still fun. It's called Make the Yuletide Gay, a really cute little movie. And now that I'm, like, living in the Midwest, I feel like it's set in the Midwest. If I remember correctly, I haven't seen it in a few years, so I feel like I might have new insight into some of the culture that happens in this movie. What about you?
I am watching Single All the Way, which came out last year. But I might have to see if, well, I will have watched that. I might have to have seen if I could hop on your Make the Yuletide Gay. There are a bunch that I'm like, ooh, I want to see that too. Yeah, especially the queer ones. So
Single All the Way is queer too, though, right?
Mm-hmm. I remember. Yeah.
Because we watched that for last year's movie calendar, I'm pretty sure.
We did indeed. We did indeed. And Single All the Way is pretty gay as well. Yeah. So, you know.
But then, speaking of queer and gay, November 29th is to watch a queer film. And I'm watching Female Trouble, the John Waters classic from 1974, starring Divine. I'm so excited. Well, I will have watched that by this point, but I'm so excited to, as a prepared to watch. This timeline thing is really confusing. But as a prepared to watch it, before, as we're recording this, I'm very excited. When this movie comes out, when this episode comes out, I will have been very happy to have watched it. I guess. I don't know. What about you? Yeah.
I am excited to hopefully have watched it with you, but I will be watching Let It Snow, which is one of my absolute favorites. It is Love Actually as it could and should have been.
I love it.
And a little bit younger, but also Tangerine is one that would be available to watch. So, yeah.
Then for November 30th, so this would have been yesterday when this episode comes out, set in the global south.
Feast of Saint Andrew.
Yes, yes.
Which is, you know, the patron saint of Scotland, Russia, Ukraine, Romania, and Greece. And so we decided to go with global south.
Makes so much sense. I'm watching Just Another Christmas. I don't know anything about this really. I just, as I was kind of looking up ideas and options to watch this, that's what came up. So I'm excited to watch it, and maybe I can report on that. Well, we'll be reporting on these on like TikTok and Twitter and stuff, so you can seek that out and hear what I think of that movie.
Yep.
What about you?
Check the socials for sure. I'm planning to have watched Santa Claus from 1959.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm excited. I think it's a Spanish language one. I think I still have to... I'm not confident that I know how to watch all of these. Like, I don't know if all of these ones that we're listing right now are available. But also my backups, and one that I will see at some point because I love elephants, is Holiday in the Wild. Or another one that looked possibly interesting is Grumpy Christmas from 2021. Ooh. So we'll see how that goes.
Very nice. Very nice. And then, go ahead.
Today,
yeah.
Today for December 1st is 1940s. We have kind of one decade theme a week.
Yep.
And our first one is 1940s. So what are you watching for that?
So today, when this episode is coming out, I will be watching Miracle on 34th Street, the original 1947, with Shirley Temple, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. I've only ever seen the remake, so I'm excited to watch this original one.
Same. I think I'm going to have to like bold all of your selections that I really want to watch with you.
I love it.
Just so that we can like in our document. I am planning to watch It's a Wonderful Life, which I have only ever seen one other time.
Oh, wow.
That was a while, like just a couple years, like recently.
I feel like I've seen that not like start to finish, but like it's on TV so much this time of year that I've like seen it. I have seen it start to finish a few times, but like at least once a year, I've seen part of that movie just because it's so pervasive in our culture. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I'm surprised you haven't been able to see it except once before. So that'll be fun.
I missed a bunch of the like classic movies. So like I also have never seen Casablanca.
Yeah, you're not missing much though. So, do not worry for our horror fans there. I have a lot of horror movies that I picked for this Advent Misfony calendar that I will get to in future weeks. It just didn't work with the prompts for this one.
Well, but I'm excited. Female Trouble is supposed to be horror adjacent, so.
Yeah, it's horror adjacent. And Yeah, so there's a little bit there, but I have some fun stuff coming up, so you'll just have to stay tuned. But because this is a horror podcast, I would feel remiss if I didn't at least name one horror thing that I plan to be doing that I have watched recently. So recently I watched Pearl, which is the prequel to the movie X, and I so greatly enjoyed that. It came out in 2022 this year. Really, really fun. I liked it more than X, and people were saying that X was like really, really good. So the fact that I like Pearl even more than the one that got all the accolades, I think is just telling how much of a fun movie it is. So have you watched anything spooky aside from stuff for this podcast?
No. I mean, I have watched some spookily cheesy Christmas things.
There.
But no, I don't think I have. Even the Christmas things were not that spooky. I haven't, because I'm watching the like ones that I wanted to watch, but didn't make it on our calendar planning. And so those are ones that I really like, not ones that are spookily terrible. So I'm not sure if I'll get to The Night Before Christmas, Night with a K, this year. That's one of the spookily terrible ones.
I weirdly enjoy that one, even though, like you said, it has some really spooky like ramifications for like just abandoning one.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to give too many spoilers for those who haven't seen it. But anyway, yeah, it's a
weird one. I liked it too, and then Susanna was talking about it, and I tried to watch it again, and I was like, so maybe, I don't know, maybe in my like watching things by myself, it'll come back around this year. We'll see. We'll see how desperate I get.
Yep. One other quick thing to shout out, which this time of year, I weirdly get into baking competition shows. So I've been watching so much Holiday Baking Championship, which I do every year. I basically rewatch all the past. It's like an annual tradition. I'll just rewatch all the past seasons and then up to and currently watch through the new season as it airs. But I've also been on this.
I've never seen that one.
It's fun. I have a Discovery Plus subscription just for it. Like, I only ever get it just for the 2 months of November and December to watch this stuff. But with that Discovery Plus subscription also comes a show that I was obsessed with ages ago, and then I could never find it to watch the newer seasons, which is How the Universe Works. Mm-hmm. And I love the show, and it's on Discovery Plus, so I've been watching that as well. And I just finished the newest season, and it has some really cool stuff in there about the big rip hypothesis for how the universe ends. This is really nerdy. Mm-hmm. I'm probably so many of our listeners, but it's okay. Just bear with me. But anyway, it's It is horror adjacent because it's kind of a horrifying end to how the universe works, but it also kind of ties in with themes of theosis, deification of union with God, which we talked a lot about in our Sunshine episode. So just kind of want to shout that out and that I'm obsessed with that show. And if nerds at church ever wants to have me on to talk about how the universe works, even though I'm not like a astrophysicist, I would love to be on and just talk about like theories of the universe, dark matter, dark energy, all that stuff from
Oof,
a
I do
pop
love that.
sci perspective, not a
Yeah,
science perspective,
that would be
obviously.
fascinating. We are going to have Nerds at Church is going to have special guest slash crossover episode. So Horror Nerds at Church did a crossover episode for Hocus Pocus, where Kay came on our show. And then we did a crossover mini, not a crossover, so-called mini-sode that we put on both of our channels. And then coming up this month, later this month for Advent 4, Pace is going to be on Nerds at Church to talk about dreams and nightmares because that's what our deep dive is.
Right.
Okay.
Interesting. Which, holy shit, did you just make a great opening for a transition? Look at this.
Oh my gosh, I did! It's amazing! It's a miracle!
It is. It's a Christmas miracle or a Thanksgiving week miracle. I don't know.
It's a December 1st miracle.
Yes. So we are covering Wes Craven's New Nightmare, 1994, came out for the 10th anniversary of the Nightmare on Elm Street series, directed by Wes Craven, the director of the original film. And get ready to take your shot, folks. When was the first time you've seen this one, Emily?
For this episode, we watched it just the other day.
Holy shit. I had no idea. I was not expecting that.
Such a surprise.
I actually have a very distinct, this is one of only two in this franchise that I actually have a distinct memory the first time I watched it.
Ooh.
Which was my mom was in the process of getting a divorce, and she loved the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And so when this movie came out, she rented it, but she was too scared to watch it by herself, and she did not have her husband to watch it with her. So she invited 9-year-old Pace to watch this movie with her. And I watch it,
Seems like a
and I
questionable
remember.
parenting decision.
I mean, at this point, I had seen all the other nightmares, so like,
That's fair.
but
You'd been somewhat desensitized.
many, many times over, in fact. But so I watched this one in my mom's like waterbed, which the waterbed tied with the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise has its own thing. Go back and listen to part four.
Yeah. I was gonna say, that seems dangerous. You need a
Right, but
second
so
mattress.
anyway. She and I were like in her bed watching on her TV, just kind of having a mom and child hangout sesh watching this movie during the day, like just like full on things. So I remember that, and I remember just being so like, I had never seen a movie that we would call today like meta, like this movie before. So like my 9-year-old brain was just like exploding with like, holy shit, I didn't know this was possible. What are the ramifications of this for my worldview and view of pop culture and stuff? So like I it had a very distinct impression on me, which lasts to this day. I still this is still one of my favorites in the franchise, and just it does a really cool thing that is not done too often and has been copied many times since, but like this is one of the first ones that really kind of plays with reality in a way that this does. So I have a little bit of background for this one. So Freddy died in 1991, apparently, with Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare.
Indeed.
So in the intervening years since, we talked a little bit before how Wes Craven and Bob Shea kind of had a falling out. Bob Shea's the head of New Line Studios, and Wes and Wes Craven really wasn't involved in the franchise. He came out with the story for part three. He had a few notes for part two, but like he basically distanced himself and did his own thing during this time. And after Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare, the 10th anniversary of Nightmare on Elm Street was approaching, and Bob Shea was like, did we kill off Freddy too soon? Maybe. And he also, I guess, wanted to make amends with Wes Craven. So he paid Wes Craven large sums of money from the success of Nightmare on Elm Street, basically saying like, yeah, our studio owes so much to you for this franchise, so we'll kind of like pay you give you more of the money than we had previously agreed to, because it really is rightfully yours as creator of the franchise. And they kind of worked out their differences. Wes Craven,
it's almost came back. Like reparations make a difference.
Almost, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so, even though Freddy was dead, they wonder if there's a way to bring him back for the 10th anniversary. So Wes Craven watched all the films. He hadn't really seen any of them since then. Aside from the first three. And he's like, yeah, this is a mess. I'm just going to throw these out. And so he came up with this idea to do this really meta thing, disregard the continuity of all the films, and really just only reference the first film. There are minor references to the remaining films here and there, but like it really is a love letter in a sense to the original film.
Mm-hmm.
It works for a 10th anniversary of that film, I think.
Yeah.
As they were filming, there is some real life inspiration for pieces of this. So there was, in early 1994, a major earthquake in Los Angeles, the Northridge earthquake. It was a 6.7 on the Richter scale. And it did a lot of damage. So as they were talking about earthquakes in the film, they were able to actually go out and get real footage of some of the damage from the earthquakes and incorporate that into the film, make it more real in that sense.
Yeah.
A reoccurring theme in the film is Heather Langenkamp having a stalker. That was based on real life. In real life, Heather Langenkamp had a stalker. And
was the stalker as creepy as the movie stalker? Like, the movie stalker is actually like a Freddy demon.
I think it was pretty creepy. But what's interesting, though, is like,
I just want to clarify. I'm not saying like a normal stalker. I mean like, was the stalker being Freddy-like or that sort of a thing?
I think there was an aspect of
creepy. All that, stalkers are bad.
Yeah, I think there was an aspect of them. It was definitely because of the Nightmare on Elm Street series, which inspired the stalker. What's interesting is Wes was being very open with the cast about, like, this is what we're doing, it's a meta thing. If you're not comfortable, that's okay. We don't need to do it. But like, had conversations with Heather, and she gave permission to include things like from a real life, like the stalker, and real life things like she is really married to a special effects guy. And she really does have kids. Both her kid and her husband were played by actors in the film. They weren't her real husband and child, but those parts are kind of based on real life. Yep. And then also just, there's a lot of cameos at the funeral scene. So Nick Corey played Rod from the first Nightmare on Elm Street. He was there. Tuesday Knight was there, who played Kristen in part four. The scene set at the New Line Cinema offices were the real offices, and most of the office workers were just really office workers working there. Bob Shea plays himself. Robert Englund plays himself. Wes Craven plays himself. The receptionist plays herself, not even an actor, but the receptionist who greets Heather Langenkamp is a real receptionist. So a lot of cool stuff there. Mm-hmm. And then the last thing I kind of want to say about background stuff is that the meta themes of this film continue in Wes Craven's later work in the Scream franchise. So this is kind of like a paving the way for what would become one of the biggest slasher franchises of the 90s and continuing. So
I prefer the term meditary.
Meditary.
Which is where my brain went when you started talking. Meditary, like meta commentary.
Yes, meditary.
Make it
I love it.
meditary. You heard it here first, folks.
Love it, love it. Cool. I'll ask just because. Do you have any background, Emily?
Absolutely not. Except that, well, I will say they, as I think is typical, did not do their research for basically anything except for the earthquake, I guess. The way that they treat the DHS intervention at the hospital is like not how it would have happened. All sorts of things. But
I wonder though if that's intentional, because at this point of the film, we're getting to a place where like the reality is so blurred, like how much of that is actually
intentional?
Twisted to make it more horrifying. And
yeah, and I would think that, except that so many people have really skewed, like if it were something where people actually know like generally how things are supposed to work, then maybe. But my experience with movies, TV shows, all of that stuff is that nobody actually like gives an accurate picture of what a referral to DHS or that sort of thing looks like when it comes to a child's hospitalization.
Sure.
Fair. Yeah.
Well, I guess we'll get into the summary then. To continue Emily's theme of a one-sentence summary, my one-sentence kind of tagline for this is Freddy goes meta.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun.
So, also, I should say background, not for the movie, but for us. Pace did not tell me that the movie was Freddy Goes Meta. So I started out and it was just another Nightmare on Elm Street movie for me, type of movie for me. So I was like, oh, you're making movies to freak people out. That, okay. And then I figured out that it was a dream, but also not a dream because apparently they really died.
Yep. That was a very intentional thing because that was how I went to this movie for the first time. I think it was just in a Nightmare on Elm Street back when I was watching it 9 years old. But also I feel like the advertising of this movie and stuff intentionally made it ambiguous so that the audience going to see this would assume it's another nightmare. And I feel like that's part of the fun and surprise and twist of this is like, oh, it's something different. It's not more of the same like we thought it would be.
I think it was a good decision on your part. I just wanted to like name for our listeners,
which I think is cool, because now as we go through it, I'm really curious, especially when we get to the rating of the film, like how that worked for you. Heather Langenkamp, who is the star of A Nightmare on Elm Street, is getting weird phone calls from a stalker. She lives in a posh house with her son and her special effects hubby, and she starts dreaming of Freddy.
Also, she's like dreaming that a new Freddy movie is being made.
Yeah.
And she gets woken up by an earthquake, which is earthquake number one, and I wish I had thought to count how many earthquakes happen, whether they are in her mind or in reality, but like... Yeah. There are way too many earthquakes that happen in this movie to be like.
Yeah, there are. If I remember correctly, there are four. And the last one is the one that is in her mind. And the Northridge earthquake had.
Aftershock.
The first earthquake was 6.7 on the Richter scale, but then it had two aftershocks that were 6.0 on the Richter scale. So that's three, which kind of lines up with the movie, except for the fourth one that's in my mind.
It felt like more than four. So that's why I was like,
okay, fair.
But maybe it was just four. And I just like, I have never lived in a place that gets regular earthquakes. So that's not an
excuse. Having lived in California, this movie, earthquakes, during our deep dive, I'll quick talk about my earthquake experience, because a lot of our listeners probably have not lived in earthquake areas. And while I only experienced two that would be significant ones for me as an outsider to that area. They were scary enough that they still are lasting impression on me. Anyway, so just kind of like quit, not going like into a deep summary, but just kind of the scenes. So one of the early scenes that something is up is that her husband dies with the weird CGI crotch shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, I mean, I think driving while tired is dangerous and frequently like even more dangerous than drunk driving. But we don't have a way to like actually like enforce that. But maybe not quite in this particular way of being dangerous, but it is dangerous. So I'm there for it. Also, you were talking about the CGI crotch shot, that it's like the first, was it the first movie that it connects to?
So there are a lot of like intentional callbacks to the first film. And this is the first, so the opening scene where they're making the glove is a callback to the original opening scene where Freddy's making the glove. And then this one is a callback to Heather Langenkamp's bathtub scene. Of course, there's some interesting commentary here of Heather Langenkamp being nude and that kind of level of vulnerability as Nancy in that scene, with the claw coming up between her legs, whereas this one, the dude was fully clothed while it happened. So there's different levels of vulnerability there. But still that notion of the claw, like, coming up between the legs to cause harm and kill somebody. And that really bad CGI, the fabric is so bad. Like, that's the one scene.
The CGI in this movie was better than the last one.
Yes. But I just don't know why they couldn't have done that as a practical shot. Just have
actually
claws come up out of the fabric. Because most of the stuff in here is practical. And so that's the one scene that will like consistently take me out of the movie because it just looks so bad compared to the rest of the movie for me.
I did not notice that part. Also, then his like the marks are on his chest.
Mm-hmm.
Which also like takes it out of the like vulnerability that they're trying to like call back to. They could have made those marks elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then probably wouldn't have gotten whatever rating they got. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. After the death of Heather's husband, her son starts acting strange, like really strange, like sleepwalking, watching movies, saying weird things, quoting the Nightmare on Elm Street song, all weird, walking around with a knife, weird stuff her kid's doing.
Yeah. There's definitely this like thing throughout the movie of her, the harm for her is visited on her parents, which is part of like larger tropes about womanhood and what counts as womanhood and motherhood and all of that stuff. But like that idea of like the sins of the parents are visited on the kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And also like these themes of, Wes Craven really likes to look at the ways, as a director, he really liked to look at the ways that Freddy in particular goes out of his way to harm the innocents, whether that we count Heather Langenkamp's character as Nancy as an innocent in the first one, and now we're seeing her son as this innocent person that Freddy's going out of his way to attack, and it's kind of like the nature of Freddy. But of course, is this even Freddy? We'll get to that in a minute. We also learned that Wes Craven is writing a new Nightmare film, so Heather's dream in the beginning is real, apparently. Then we get to her son's behavior gets strange enough that she takes him to the hospital, and becomes this battle in a hospital with the doctor versus Nancy, the doctor kind of becoming a villainous figure. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we're also starting to get into the area where, like, what Nancy is experiencing, how much of this is a dream versus how much of this is reality from this point to the end of the film.
Yeah, and there's a, like, a thing that happens with all of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, which is people not believing about Freddy because It's Just a Dream. And particularly for her, because she was Nancy. She was an actor who played Nancy. And so then it's really easy for them to say, oh, are you having a like psychotic break where you are identifying with a character that you played and now can't self-differentiate?
Yeah. And the fact that it's Heather Langenkamp. So like, again, like Wes Craven, I think, is smart to this in a way that having a woman be not believed by medical establishment for something that is actually wrong with her, and kind of commenting on that. And then also I feel like there's a little bit of him commenting on this notion that horror movies or horror as a genre causes kids to misbehave or harm others, stuff like that. And him basically saying, no, that's my interpretation of that.
But
that's
not how. Yeah. Cause that's definitely one of the like things that they accuse her of is like, you've been letting him watch Nightmare on Elm Street, and she has done everything in her powers to not let him watch it. Yeah. And yet it still has been absorbed both in dreams and nightmares and on TV and all of that stuff. Yeah.
And also that commentary of like, I've been quoting this line from the very first movie, and we finally got to see it. So the payoff of it, of like, Freddy Krueger's like Santa Claus. Every kid knows who he is. Mm-hmm. And it's like true. And so there's also Wes Craven commenting on like, what does it mean that this child molester murderer is this pop culture icon that kids are dressing up as and love and want to buy merchandise for? Yeah. So there's all this stuff kind of being commented on here.
Yeah.
And this is also where that, like we've just been talking about, the film is turning in on itself and commenting on itself and commenting on the state of horror at this point. Forward. And so like the babysitter gets killed in a way very similar to how Tina died in the first one.
Mm-hmm. I thought that Julie, like the actor that played Julie or Julie, I thought she was like maybe a problem thing, some sort of evil thing. But I also like, she feels like she was one of the characters. Maybe it's, I don't know. I keep thinking that she was in the movies, but.
Yeah, she is one of the few.
She was not.
Yeah, she is one of the few that was not, but probably picked because she looks similar to Tina and stuff to kind of make those connections. Mm-hmm. Then also, so the whole time through this film, kind of as a framing narrative, Heather has been reading the story of Hansel and Gretel to her kid. Mm-hmm. So her kid escapes the hospital. There's this really weird highway scene I won't get into, but then Heather goes home, finds that her kid had left a trail of breadcrumbs, which are really just sleeping pills that she takes to follow her son into the dream world.
Mm-hmm. Which like, she's definitely gonna take too many. I thankfully they're probably like sized down for Dylan because child, but like she's popping those pills.
right. Do not follow her example. Do not try this at home.
Do you have to take the pills or just find the pills?
Right,
Hansel and Gretel didn't actually eat the breadcrumbs.
Right, but the birds did. That's true. Why they couldn't find their way home. Mm-hmm. So then she goes to this weird dream paradise. I mean, earlier we had this establishing dialogue where Wes Craven said that his idea for the script is that there is this real life evil entity that haunts people, harms people, all this stuff is evil, some sort of like demon character out there. But occasionally he can be trapped by fiction, by the stories we tell as humans, and that those stories kind of trap him and keep him from like entering into the real world. But because of the success of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, he's been trapped as Freddy to the point that he actually enjoys being Freddy. So this demon is kind of turning into Freddy or enjoys the role of Freddy. So Heather encounters him with Dylan in this weird, like, hellish landscape full of water and fire and snakes and all sorts of weird stuff. And they kind of have a show off there.
Yeah. I did not understand this.
Fair.
As I was like reading through your summary, when you were like, a demon who has taken on the role of Freddy. I was like, wait, what? I remember when Freddy is killed that it becomes like this demon looking monster thing. And I was like, oh, maybe like Freddy's a demon. I get it. But like, I didn't think it was like a demon pretending to be Freddy to do this. Like, that's a whole other thing. I thought it was just one of the reiterations, right? Like, Freddy is the three demon thingy, dream demon things. Or
it's one of those things, like, if you're not paying close, I have the, I don't know, I almost said, like, I have the benefit, but I'm not sure it's a benefit, of having watched this film, like, more times than I can count. So it's, like, one of those lines that Wes Craven says when he's talking to Nancy about the new script he's working on. And like, that's kind of, like, where that dialogue happens. So if you weren't paying too close attention there, then when it brings it back later, you might not catch it.
Yeah, well, and at that point, it's like, maybe Wes Craven is, like, it's not as set that Wes Craven is, like, what he's writing is what is happening.
I think
it's, like, right when you're trying to figure that out. But, yeah. Also, I would just like to say that in all of these, I think I have officially decided that Freddy's tongue is the creepiest part of all of them.
Right. It's a really creepy tongue, and especially how it's used in many different ways in the first film, and then this way as kind of like really phallic in some parts, and then also like serpent-like in some parts. It's just like gross. So true to Hansel and Gretel, they push Freddy into a furnace and he dies, apparently, or dream demon Freddy, whatever he actually is. And then they wake up. Wes Craven's new script is delivered, and Heather reads it to her son, and we see that the script is actually the events of the movie. This is the second time we see this, which just kind of reiterates, like, as she's reading the script, it's like she's saying the exact dialogue that is written in the script. So, and then the movie's over.
I think I like Wes Craven.
Right? He's awesome. Like, he's still a white dude. He still made most of his films in the 70s through the early 2000s before he passed. So, like, definitely problematic parts, especially his early filmography. But overall, I feel like he is really smart and really tries to do justice to the characters he writes in a way that a lot of other people do not. So,
yeah, I'd be down for covering another Wes Craven franchise, especially if it's one that comes after Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, we'll get to Scream at one of these times. That'll be a fun franchise to cover. So,
indeed.
Okay, so our deep dive. I don't have much here because we kind of already were touching through it. I really have two big things I want to touch on. So the first is the meta nature of this film. And before I get into that, I can't hold off asking anymore, like, what did you think seeing this without any prep into it?
I really loved it, actually. Like, I really loved the last Freddy film that we saw, but I loved this one in a whole different way. I like the meta stuff. I was talking with one of my housemates, Matt, and this is one of the episodes or one of the movies in the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise that he's actually seen. And he loves the movie Inception. And so we were talking about that some after I had watched it. And so we were talking. So I actually, like, knew those things. And it was just, like, it's always this, like, whole other level of, like, mind fuck. Like, where you're just like, whoa, is this? And Nightmare on Elm Street as a franchise already kind of does that, because it's, is this dream or is this reality? And it's always playing with that, but to do it to this extent was just, like, really cool, and I really appreciated it.
I've since, like, seen films before and after this that do this kind of thing, but like I said, this was the first film that I ever saw that did this. And lots of times I've seen it done as jokes. So, like, the Ocean's 11 franchise, with George Clooney and stuff, they have Julia Roberts playing a character in that named Tess in the second one. Mm-hmm. They're like, you know, you look a lot like Julia Roberts. So they have Tess play Julia Roberts. And then in the credits, like it has Tess credit. Tess was played by Julia Roberts and Julia Roberts was played by Tess, the character's name. So I just mm-hmm. thought that was like kind of fun. It's a cute little joke. But like mm-hmm. to do it for horror like this is just so effective because you're like watching, you know, if you're as big into the franchise as I am, you know all the cameos of people you're seeing. You see them playing themselves. And so it just kind of adds this level of like, holy shit, this is like in the real world supposedly happening and stuff like mm-hmm. that. So.
Yeah, and sorry, there's a truck driving. Yeah, and I think partly too, like there are other shows that kind of do meta stuff. And a lot of the time it's breaking the fourth wall. Like, there's mm-hmm. a breaking the fourth wall sense of it. And even the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, I think was it the last one that broke the fourth wall?
Quite a bit, yeah. Like, when he steers right at the camera is like, and makes a one-liner and stuff like yeah. that. Yeah.
But this was meta without breaking the fourth wall, which is, like, I think a lot harder to do and, a mm-hmm. whole other level of engagement with the, like...
Yeah.
brain and mind and thinking and like I don't know, they say that when you're watching TV or something your brain is doing less work than when you're sleeping, but I have to believe that like with horror it can't possibly be true because your brain is constantly trying to figure out what's going on, and then when you add in like the meta levels of stuff, it's like yeah. it's too much to feast on.
It's really disorienting. And the fact that, like, when this movie came out, it was a few months after the Northridge earthquake. So it's like, there's so many real life elements that happened in this mm-hmm. movie that were brought in from the real world into the movie that is hard not to. That is, it already just in and of itself is blurring that line between fiction and reality in a really cool way.
Yeah.
And then... we talked a little bit throughout the summary of like the ways that Wes Craven was using this to comment on horror, to comment on pop culture, to stuff like that. But one of the things that really intrigues me is this notion of this, of basically saying that the stories we tell as people have a way of having real world effects on harnessing evil, helping people process and deal with evil, keeping people safe. Like this notion that the very stories we tell aren't just like fiction, but exist in the real world in some way that can have real world ramifications. And mm-hmm. of course, we as progressives see that all the time in the ways that which like the stories that only feature white people, for instance, do not show reality as it is and then create these harmful environments for people of color, all sorts of stuff like that. And so for him to see that and comment on that, and then also bring in this level of like the myths we tell, like when we say myths about like Satan, for instance, or Lucifer, and he kind of implies that like these biblical myths about evil and stuff like that, mm-hmm. are based on some sort of reality of there being real world evil that we can kind of capture. And in telling these stories, we are warning each other about it. We're keeping that evil at bay in some way. I just find that all that fascinating. Yeah. And one of the reasons why I love horror and one of the reasons why I think Wes Craven really loved horror is because it has all these properties that we can mm-hmm. use it for.
Well, and I think that's really interesting because I was listening to NPR the other day, and they were talking about Twitter, right? Which is, as Kay and I said the last time we recorded, who knows if Twitter will actually exist by the time this episode comes out, because of all of the things happening at Twitter. But one of the things that they were talking about, they were talking to someone who used to be a contractor engineer at Twitter who did like the algorithms to do around political disinformation and trying to like find and remove political disinformation. And then they talked about somebody who was a reporter who reported on Twitter. And then they talked with somebody who was a reporter. And then they also talked with somebody who was an investor, an Elon Musk investor. And they actually didn't let that person just like lie about all of the things, right? But what they did do is they were talking about the ways misinformation and disinformation get told and retold, and like how those inform people. And so like the allowing Trump back on Twitter, right, allows disinformation to spread even more and even more rapidly. And people were talking about it with another thing that I was listening to, I think, too. But just this, like, so it's not just that Wes Craven is talking about these demons and the ways that they name like actual evil in the world, but it's also like taking it a step further and getting at the ways that the stories we make up about people, right? The stories that we make up about immigrants to rile up a base to go vote for a particular party are really dangerous. And that this is the first time that you and I are recording after the attack on Club Q, and the alleged attacker, had been privy to a lot of really harmful theology and harmful messaging from religious leaders in the name of Christianity, and it manifested itself in this person in as real and true evil. And so that space of what does it look like and how do we like navigate that is, I think, really interesting. And I think it's also complicated by the fact that so often queer people and villains are coded together, right? Like villains are so often queer coded. And so then how do you navigate being constantly seen as the villain?
Yeah.
And what does that look like?
Yeah, 100%. And also, as we talked about before, like part of that navigating is frequently kind of claiming these villains as part of our family in a way that, oh, look at them terrorizing the cishets. Good for you.
Right, kind of thing. Right.
The positive way. But of course, right, as you're saying, they're the real world negative and harmful ways that happen. I saw my stuff. I said I was going to talk about earthquakes, so I can quick tell my two earthquake stories. I'll keep them short. So when I was living in Berkeley, there were two significant earthquakes, both over 5 on the Richter scale. Not nearly as big or harmful as the one depicted in the film that was also based on a real world. But even so, they both happened at night. The first one happened, my ex slept through it, but like I was awake because I don't sleep. And it really felt like a truck hit the side of our building. It was just this huge, like sudden, like bang, and then everything just like shuddered, and then it was over. Like it was just this really quick thing, which is one way earthquakes happen. Then another way that earthquakes happen was the second one, where it feels like where it's more the shaking kind and stuff like that. So the fact that there are different kinds of earthquakes, which is something I did not even know, both are horrifying. The truck one was done in an instant, but the shaking one lasted a little bit longer, and it was just kind of terrifying in and of itself for those reasons. So even minor ones can be horrifying, and it's fun to see it depicted in this film.
Yeah, and I grew up in Colorado. We don't do earthquakes in Colorado. I actually have thought about this on and off throughout being an adult and the places I've lived, that like where I grew up is like one of the least dangerous places to grow up in terms of natural disasters, because like you can get caught in an avalanche, maybe you have to be in particular places to get caught in an avalanche, but an avalanche is not going to like accidentally wipe out your school. And lower in elevation you could get hit by a mudslide. But like really, a wildfire is like the only thing that's a natural disaster that will like hit you. And those have been pretty rampant in Colorado. Yeah. To catch up for when Colorado was like not letting things naturally burn. But I never had earthquakes. I never had hurricanes. I never had tornadoes. I never had floods, mm-hmm. like all of that stuff. So for me, it's just like this completely foreign concept. But I really appreciated the way this movie takes like every possible aspect of horror. Like, mm-hmm. there's an aspect of psychological horror that's always in it, but not like Silence of the Lambs kind. But there's the like horror of natural disasters. So the horror of earthquakes and like, especially the first one when she wakes up and she's terrified that Dylan's going to get hurt and all of that stuff. Yeah. But then there's also the horror of technology, right? That they're creating this hand for this movie in her dream that then takes on a life of its own, and the ways that like artificial intelligence and technology can become horrific. And then there's also the like regular Nightmare on Elm Street horror, and there's the gendered violence kind of horror, and the ways that it like she's dealing with harassment and she's dealing with stalkers, and the particular space, we didn't talk about it in the summary, but when she's on the talk show,
mm-hmm.
and like is in the background having this experience of a stalker who is acting like Freddy, and then gets surprised on live TV by Robert Englund as Freddy. And everybody in the audience dressed up as Freddy and like all of that stuff. I was like, that is horrible. Like that would be so horrific in that moment to have mm-hmm. that experience. Like, yeah.
And also the horror of phones in a world before caller ID and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So that's a recurring thing. So it's like a lot of our younger millennials and especially Gen Z folk, just for those of us who are older millennials and generations above, especially in the age before everybody had an answering machine, if the phone rang, you're like expected to answer it and just deal with whoever's on the other side. And that's why like people are like, why would you answer the phone if you're getting called by soccer? It's like, because it could be something else. And it turned out to be like the limo driver or something like that. And so that happens a lot in horror movies. And people are like, I wouldn't answer the phone. It's like, yeah, I don't answer the phone for anybody either. But there was a time in your life when it's kind of expected. If the phone rang, you answered it, period.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a whole other thing. One of the things in the movie that caught my attention was, I guess I just got like got caught by a lot of little things, but the scene where Heather has arrived at the office and Sarah, who is like her handler, it's not really her handler, but is like welcoming her and bringing her back to the office, is like, can I get you something to drink? And Heather says, sure. And then Sarah says to an assistant, can you get coffees? And I was like, this is Abraham's hospitality to a T. Hey, angels in Genesis, right? Hey, angels, come. Let me provide food and water, rest, all of that stuff. And they're like, okay. And then he's like, Sarah, go do the things. And it's just like, okay, like, I get... So I was like,
right,
Sarah.
Or even
which is also ironic because her name is Sarah.
So. Yeah. But even when like Bob Shay like is like, Heather's like, are you gonna answer the phone? He's like, no, that's what we pay people here to do, is answer mm-hmm. the phone. It's like, cool. Must be nice to be that kind of corporate culture where you have women around to just do all your heavy mm-hmm. lifting for you, so you can sit in an office all day and do nothing.
Yeah. Also, I thought it was going to be a creepy, like, pick up the phone and something creepy would be going on. There were a couple times where I was like, oh, this is a, like, I know this trope. I know what happens. And then it didn't.
An intentional misdirection. Look at Wes Craven using intentional misdirection as a way to amplify the horror. It's like he deserves the title Horror Master, which he has been given.
Yeah. I also really loved the way that, I think this one does better than, certainly than the, I think, Nightmare on Elm Street 5, on like how it engages with kids and like what it means to be a parent. There's definitely like the complexities of Heather Langenkamp and like how much of her identity then becomes wrapped up in being parent to the child. But there's also this like beautiful treatment of a child that like, if you are a parent, like, yeah, this is your job, is to like repair Rex. And so that Rex, like, I have stuffed animals who have had surgeries. Like, that's real. That's what you do to the stuffed animals. You repair them so that they can live to fight again. And so that particular space, I was like, this is a beautiful thing. And then reading the scary stories to the kids so that they can move through scariness and know that you are still there and they can get to the other end where it gets resolved.
So what you're saying is my mom introducing me to horror movies was not a bad parenting choice.
It's true. It's true. I still think there are ways to do it that are age appropriate that may or may not have happened. But yeah, I think that especially when kids already have the experiences of real life horror, there is a way of like acknowledging that and talking about it that's really important. And too often it just gets hidden and then it gets buried and then it comes out really weirdly in adulthood and all of that stuff.
Anything else for our deep dive?
I think that's all I've really got. Yeah, I think Wes Craven has done a really good job.
Agreed. Which, again, you just perfectly are setting us up for a transition into rating the film. So out of 10 nightmares, how would you rate this? And do you have a favorite kill from the movie?
Yeah, I'm going to give it 9. Nice. I really like this one a lot.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting if we ever like revisit them and do like a movie commentary on any of them to see if like my opinion about the first one changes now that I've seen all of these. But for now, I really liked this one.
Do you have a favorite kill from it?
Her husband. Like, he was doing something in secret and not talking to her about, like, it's a justice kill in some respects. But also just the like flipping of the script and the like that those different pieces of it, I think, all combined. I don't even know her husband's name, but her husband.
Yeah, I don't either.
He doesn't need a name. He can be defined by his relationship to a woman.
Exactly. Yeah, I'll rate this 9.5 nightmares. It is, for a while, it was my favorite in the franchise. I liked it even more than the original. But now that I've seen the entire franchise the whole way through, like, a billion times, the first one still just kind of goes a little bit above for me as my favorite. And we'll get more into that in our...
It's because of my favorite kill scene, isn't it?
In the first one?
No, this one doesn't quite make it.
Oh, no. But the original one is just like so tight in how it tells the story, whereas this one is a little bit more expansive, which is okay and good. It's just a different type of telling a story.
Yeah. Also, they bring the house back for this one.
I know, right? One, it makes sense because she's like she's going into the dream world she lived in, whereas the rest of them is like, why at this house? I don't get it. But that's a really cool scene. And so, like, I guess, so my favorite kill, I'll quick say, is the death of the babysitter who is like a reimagining of the death of Tina. Mm-hmm. But basically, beginning of that death up until Heather walking into the house and it turning into the original dream house is probably my favorite part of the movie, where there's all these callbacks to the original to the point of like, you are starting to feel the anxiety of Heather's character of like, what the fuck is happening? Like, why is my co-star from the first film thinking he's my dad now all of a sudden? Why am I suddenly in the nightgown that I wore in the first film? Why is this house of, why is this person saying I need a pass and I'm saying screw your pass, just like the first movie? Like, it's like, there's one way to do callbacks like as Easter eggs for fans, but then there's another way to do it here where it's like intentional to even the characters are like, wait, why is this happening in exactly familiar way? And so I just love that whole bit. So that's probably my favorite.
I missed some of those parts for sure, but I did catch the, like, why is he saying he's my dad part.
So, oh, just such a good movie. I'm so glad you liked it too.
Yeah, me too. I did not jump, but I did gasp at one point in the beginning. I had a gasp moment in, I think it was in her dream when they were doing the like CGI hand stuff. And it first started getting out of hand. That was a good one.
Was it?
No, it was not even intentional. Like, it came into my mind and then I realized it, and so then I said it. But like, it just popped in all on its own.
Well, I guess we will lay this one to rest. We still have two more movies in the franchise, so good luck with those, Emily. Freddy versus Jason.
So far they're like getting better and better, so who knows what will happen.
I won't say anything other than Freddy versus Jason is back to the original continuity. And then we get a remake, Nightmare on Elm Street, came out in 2010, and we'll see what you think of both of those. And our next movie is Everything Everywhere All at Once from this year, 2022, directed by the Daniels with special guest River Cook Needham. I'm so excited for this. As soon as I saw this movie in theaters, I'm like, we are going to cover this on the show, even though it's not fully horror. There are horror elements, and I just cannot wait. So.
Anything is horror.
Yes, anything is horror if you want it to be. And I want this to be horror so I can cover it on the podcast. And also kind of continue some of the meta-ish kind of themes from this one. So it kind of fits.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. It was fun. And I definitely want to watch the movie again before we record. But that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt Warfield May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you catch your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up, cheaper than the insurance at living in an earthquake zone. For sure. Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPod, and Twitter at HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, don't cry over spilled coffee unless it's the only thing saving you from Freddy.
Love it. Yay. Thank you.